this is not news here. We certainly know in Chicago that Alden Global Capital owns the Chicago Tribune right now, and their MO is to sort of gut the papers, fire the columnists, get as many freelancers and part-timers as they can. Eventually, they sell the real estate and anything they can associated with their properties, and that's how they make money. In the article, he writes, "The men who devised this model are Randall Smith and Heath Freeman, the co-founders of Alden Global Capital. Since they bought their first newspapers a decade ago, no one has been more mercenary or less interested in pretending to care about their publication's long-term health. Alden now controls more than 200 newspapers, including some of the country's most famous and influential, the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun, the New York Daily News. It is the nation's second largest newspaper owner by circulation, and some in the industry say they would not be surprised if Smith and Freeman, these two guys, end up becoming the biggest newspaper moguls in U.S. history. They are also defined by an obsessive secrecy. Alden's website contains no information beyond the firm's name, and its list of investors is kept strictly confidential. When lawmakers pressed for details last year on who funds Alden, the company replied that, quote, there may be certain legal entities and organizational structures formed outside the United States. Whatever that means. I must say, you know, I don't have the resources personally of The Atlantic or The New York Times or whoever would look further into this, including the Chicago Tribune. But it was pretty amazing that when we were trying to just get basic contact information for this hedge fund with such resources, they can buy up the biggest newspapers in the United States. You go to their website and there's nothing. It's just like a landing page. You can't find anybody to say you can't get anybody. I mean, we didn't think we'd get anybody, but at least get to people that will say that. We couldn't even find them. In fact, props to this guy that he at least got people that would say no comment. And actually, he did get a comment from one of the owners. Smith, a reclusive Palm Beach septuagenarian, hasn't granted a press interview since the 1980s. And Freeman, his 41-year-old protege, the president of the firm, would be unrecognizable in most of the newsrooms he owns. For two men who employ thousands of journalists, remarkably little is known about them. Now, the guy that wrote this is on a line right now. Let's talk a little bit to McKay Coppins. Hey, McKay, it's John Williams, and you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for writing this piece. It's a long piece. You must enjoy the opportunity to put that many words into one topic.
Yeah, it's definitely a luxury that The Atlantic affords, that, you know, they give me months to look into these stories, and I do think it's an important topic.
Well, we sure do in Chicago, although, you know, we've dealt with this to some degree. We saw this coming. There was this appeal locally to find somebody who would buy the newspaper rather than this hedge fund. It looked like that might happen, then it didn't happen. Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey didn't step up. Ken Griffin didn't step up. There were people that could have done this. We'd hope that there might even be some sort of civic appeal, right? So it would almost be a philanthropic effort on somebody's part. Didn't happen. So now a lot of our favorite columnists are gone. The staff has been cut. The paper is thinner, and we're reading the Tribune that way. That's no surprise to you or them, for that matter, right?
Well, it's not only because it's a model that these guys at Alden Capital have followed for a decade at all the newspapers they buy. They've developed kind of a very straightforward model where they buy a newspaper, whether it's a small local paper or a big one like the Chicago Tribune, and they immediately, you know, cut the staff, sell any real estate holdings the paper has, move the reporters to, you know, smaller digs sometimes, you know, attached to the printing press plant. They will find other ways to save money, such as outsourcing layout design to the Philippines. In many cases, they'll actually increase subscription prices because, as some industry observers have noted, it'll take a certain amount of time for subscribers to realize that they're paying more for a worse product. And altogether, the model is designed not with the long-term viability or health of the newspaper in mind, but with short-term profit maximization in mind. And so the model that they're following, the Chicago Tribune, has played out in dozens of markets across the country over the past 10 years.
So this the older of the two is Randall Smith. Do I have that right? He's
That's
the septuagenarian.
Right. Yep.
And you write a little bit about him. Can you just tell us a little bit about this guy or his father and how they came to be so powerful?
Yeah, he's a really interesting character. Like you mentioned at the beginning of this, he hasn't given an interview to the press, as far as I could tell, since the 1980s. He's very secretive, private, reclusive guy. But if you look into kind of what has been written about him and the documentation of his track record, it's fascinating. He was actually one of the first investors in America to realize that there was money to be made in buying distressed companies, which is to say companies that were struggling, either on the verge of bankruptcy or in bankruptcy, and then basically breaking them up into pieces and selling them off. The term vulture capitalism hadn't been invented when he started doing this, but he was kind of a pioneer of what's now known as vulture investing or vulture capitalism. And he made a fortune doing it with, you know, bankrupt aerospace manufacturers or drilling companies. And he's an interesting person because, you know, if you, for example, his son gave an interview to D Magazine in Dallas a few years ago and said that he remembers once asking his father why he worked so hard. And his father said, this is Randall Smith, it's a game. And his son asked, how do you know who wins? And Randall Smith replied, whoever dies with the most money. And so you can kind of see his worldview coming into shape. He didn't really start applying this model to the newspaper industry until the tail end of the Great Recession, when he teamed up with Heath Freeman, who would become his protege.
And in fact, he would probably agree with everything you said. Was it not he who had the vulture over his door, or a painting of a vulture, right?
Yeah, it was reported in the 90s that his firm actually had a painting of a vulture in its lobby. This is according to the Village Voice.
You know, which is so, you know, funny, but it's not.
Well, he just, I think the thing about him and Heath Freeman, who I did end up talking to, is that they do not care about their standing in the world of journalism, right? They don't care about their reputations for ruthlessness. In fact, I got the impression talking to Heath Freeman that he actually wore his reputation for ruthlessness as a kind of badge of honor. He kind of bragged to me that the past generations of newspaper owners in America weren't willing to make the tough decisions that he was. And so I think that in the world that they occupy, the world of high finance and hedge funds, what makes them successful, the status differentiators, are their returns for their investors, right? And if they have figured out a way to essentially profit as they drive these newspapers into the ground. And, you know, that makes a lot of journalists angry. And I think it should make people in the communities these newspapers serve concerned. But in the world that they live in, it, you know, that doesn't matter as much as the money that they're making for themselves and their investors.
Earlier, I said that this story would make a Gordon Gekko blush. At least at the end, Gordon Gekko got a heart, but these guys do not. And I want you to tell me a little bit more about them, because if they make a movie about this, it could be about the poor little Chicago Tribune. But the more interesting movie would be the story of this guy. We'll pick up this story with McKay Coppin in a minute. This is WGN. We're talking to McKay Coppins. His piece in The Atlantic is about the secretive hedge fund that is gutting newsrooms, and we know about that. The Chicago Tribune is one of them. And McKay, I must say that your description when I was reading your piece about one of these guys, I thought, well, this isn't real, the story of Randall Smith. But I just want to read from your piece and get you to react to it. You said, the story of Alden Capital begins on the set of a 1960s TV game show called Dream House. A young man named Randall Duncan Smith, Randy for short, stands next to his wife, Catherine, answering quick-fire trivia questions in front of a live studio audience. The show's premise pits two couples against each other for the chance to win a home. And when the Smiths win, they pass on the house and they take the cash prize instead, a $20,000 haul that Randy will eventually use to seed a small trading firm he calls R.D. Smith and Company. I mean, that's the opening scene. that's just hard to believe. But then that's the seed money he uses to open up his trading firm. He eventually realizes the vulture capitalism is a way to strip companies of their assets and get rich. And that's cinematic, that whole moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny that I knew as soon as I came across that had to be kind of a key scene in the story, because I think so often these huge, important, sweeping stories come down to these small, seemingly silly moments that, you know, the roots are there. And I think if anything of the last 5 years of American life has taught us that that's often the case. But, you know, Randall Smith, I think there's something interesting about the fact that, you know, he and his wife, they're a young couple. They decide to pass on the house and use this money instead to seed a trading firm that he starts, because that kind of becomes a theme throughout his life. You know, I mentioned the conversation he had with his son at one point. He taught his 8-year-old son to make trades on a Quotron computer when he's 8 years old. At one point, there's a story that he taught his family sort of the value of delayed gratification by postponing his family's Christmas so that he could use all their family's available funds to buy stocks in December when they're at bargain prices. And so, you know, this is a guy whose worldview is kind of defined by pure hypercapitalism, right? That's it's all wins and losses. It's money on a spreadsheet. And that's what drives him.
Yeah, for its own sake. I mean, so dang. And then he decides to find journalism as the area that he'd like to actually exercise his vulture capitalistic principles. And I don't want to overstate the case, but there's also something almost sociopathic about him. That is, when you become so wealthy that you have 16 mansions and an intrepid reporter can't even figure out which door to knock on, you are that wealthy, right? And you must know that people and whole cities are suffering because of your want to just keep making more money. He doesn't have to be doing this way, but he does. He's got that drive. And it seems unhealthy to me. It seems wrong-footed to me.
Well, and that's kind of what was actually compelling about him as a figure to me right at the beginning of this story. Like, when I first started to look into it, I had a conversation with one of my editors, and he was saying, you know, there are lots of ways to make money if you're a hedge fund. You know, they could be buying widget companies and, you know, turning them around and selling them for a profit. The fact that he's zeroed in on this ailing industry that pretty much everyone, you know, who's being honest would acknowledge plays a vital civic role, right? And that he's gutting it so mercilessly to make money. There's something interesting there, you know, the kind of lack of remorse or shame or something, I think is interesting. And I wanted to kind of explore that.
Well, do you think there's anything about him and his history that is angry at the newspaper industry, that is mad at journalism? Mm-hmm. Does he have a Trump sort of, I'm always on the outside, I wish I was on the inside drive? I mean, what's compelling him?
So this was the key question I was trying to answer, you know, and I will say up front that there is a dispute about this question, even among the people who have worked at Alden or have known Randall Smith and Heath Freeman. The question is, are they motivated purely by, you know, greed and capitalist ambition, or is there a specific kind of hostility toward the press? And the only, you know, kind of interesting passage that I would point to in his life that might shed some light on this is amid his mounting fortune in the 90s, he took some of his own money and helped his brother start an alt-weekly newspaper in Manhattan called the New York Press. And this newspaper was kind of a strange publication. It was sort of dedicated to taking down, critiquing, railing against the media world, the journalists in New York in particular. Randall Smith's brother, Russ Smith, who ran the publication, wrote a weekly column called Mugger that often ran to 10,000 words, and he would just savage the city's journalists by name. And, you know, Randall Smith, as far as we know, had no editorial role in this newspaper, and he could have just been funding it because it was his brother and he had loyalty to him. But, you know, there are some in his circle who would point to that and say that he might have kind of a personal fixation with journalism, with journalists, and a kind of a disdain for them that might be animating some of his investment strategy.
Do they show up at the newspapers after they acquire them? Do they appear in that, you know, scene where everybody's gathered around the typewriters and they stand on a chair and say, hey, everybody, we're going to do the best we can? Do they have those moments?
Yeah, no, they do not do that. And it's important. I think this is an important note because, you know, that's pretty standard practice when a new owner buys a news outlet or a publication of some kind. Even if they know that they're going to have to make cuts, they'll come and face the staff at least once, right? Yeah. And they'll take questions and they'll say, look, we're going to do everything we can and what you're doing is important. They don't do that. When they bought the Chicago Tribune, they did not go out to the Chicago Tribune newsroom. They didn't talk to reporters. They barely even articulated their plans for the newspaper in public. You know, they declined interview requests. They kind of just remained elusive and then, you know, cut a quarter of the newsroom. And so I think that that's kind of revealing of how much they actually care about journalism and what these newspapers are about.
McKay Coppin's piece runs as long as that other one. How many words were you able to dedicate to this story?
I'd have to go check, but I think it's in the 7,000 to 8,000 word range. But I try to make it, you know, propulsive. It shouldn't feel like homework reading.
It does not. No. In fact, I'm anxious to read the follow-up, and maybe there could be down the road. But in the meantime, if you pick up The Atlantic and read A Secretive Hedge Fund is Gutting Newsrooms, it tells you more than you knew about the people that own the Chicago Tribune. McKay, it's nice to meet you. Let's talk again. Nice work on that piece.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
It's 10:56 on WGN. News from the Northwest. And by the way, this radio station has been bought and sold more than once, and sometimes under circumstances that gave all of us pause. And in each of those instances, there was a moment where you did get to meet the new people that bought the place, even though we weren't certain about what was going to happen. Turns out, lucky for us, the right people are running this ranch and it's going okay. But you never know. And boy, you at least ought to have, if you're going to do this, the courage of your convictions, the, what's the phrase, testicular fortitude to just stand up there and take it. These people are invisible.